What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Eyewitness History. I am, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. So this is a really special episode. I'm extremely excited to bring it to you. You've probably seen her before, even if you don't know the name. That name is Cynthia Garrett. You've probably seen her on the red carpet. She's been on VH1, and as if that wasn't enough, she had her own talk show. She was the first African-American woman to host a late-night talk show on a major network. She goes into some incredible stories about how she got there and the incredible historical impact she had on that industry. She even gave me her two cents on the infamous late-night wars between Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien. You do not want to miss this one. And now I give you Cynthia Garrett. Okay, I'm here with Cynthia Garrett. Cynthia, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's nice to be with you, Joshua. Thank you. Do you like Josh or Joshua?
Oh, I prefer Josh.
Okay, you can, Josh.
You know, the joke, you can call me anything as long as it's not early, right?
Yeah, right. Well, thank you, Josh. Josh is easy. I have a stepson named Josh.
Oh, excellent. I like him already. I'm really excited to be speaking with you, Cynthia. I definitely want to get into your career as the first African-American woman to be a late-night host, and certainly your life experiences. Before we get there, Cynthia, could you please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you sort of who you are and what you're doing now?
Yeah, my name is Cynthia Garrett. I have been a longtime television host, and I'm still in media. I'll probably always be in media in some form or fashion. But a number of years ago, I started really wanting to make media that matters, I guess I would call it. And so for me, matters means things that were a lot more inspirational, faith-based, more encouraging and inspiring. And so I formed a nonprofit organization, which we operate as CGM, which is Cynthia Garrett Ministries. And the whole sort of foundation of the media is I create, host, produce, whatever the need is, faith-based and inspiration-based programming. So the first production I did for TBN, which is the number one faith and family channel around the world, was called the London Sessions. And it was called the London Sessions because I launched on the channel there and I needed to have a certain amount of London-based and UK-based, you know, guests in order for me, an American, to launch on the network in the way that I did. And then once that was done and the network became a real kind of made a splash there, then I was able to start doing programming that was much more, it could be US based, it could be whatever. So then I sort of grew that program up into, out of the 1 hour talk show that it started as, into a half an hour show. The initial Cynthia Garrett sessions were, you know, kind of half an hour riffing on an issue, very Jordan Peterson like. And then that grew into, you know, I did a couple of seasons of guests. And I bring on my favorite guest a lot of the times, and that's my husband, Roger Charles, because he's like that guy that you can ask any question about pretty much any faith. And because he's a theologian and a scholar of just religions in general, he's great because we have a lot of fun, you know, trying to stump Roger and ask him questions that we all want to know, you know? So yeah, recently during the pandemic, I launched a new series called Cynthia Garrett's Girl Club. And we do have guys who watch, but it is myself and three young women. And there's one sort of young teenage 23-year-old who comes in and out also. And it's a very, you know, our moniker is Real Girls, Real Talk, Real Issues, Real Faith. And it's, you know, we sort of attack everything that has to do with our identity as people of faith. Are people even authentic about faith anymore? And how do you apply faith in a real way to your everyday life with its everyday issues? And it's really been a powerful series. So that's really where my heart is. That's where CGM is really focusing a lot of its push right now. We've gone into We're on live stream on a number of different platforms, inspiration-based platforms. We're on podcasts all over the, you know, on all your favorite podcast platforms, and just kind of growing like wildfire. We'll be doing live shows and live events soon. And we've partnered with organizations like Opportunity International in making microfinance loans to women in the poorest parts of the world and watching them change their lives, you know, and change their villages and educate their children. And we also do a lot of work with fighting sex trafficking and human trafficking around the world. You know, I partner with a lot of organizations. And then I'm a regular on Fox News, which is kind of odd because I'm a moderate, you know, independent, really, I think. But I do a lot of writing. I've written a couple of books. I write a lot of op-eds and have written columns for everyone from InStyle magazine to LA Confidential to Newsweek. And Laura Ingraham happened to read a piece I did on Newsweek during the pandemic about defunding our public schools rather than our police. And she called and said, would you come on Fox News? And I said, I'm not really the girl to argue about politics. I'm kind of looking for like the unifying factors. And she said, I know, that's great. That's why I want you on. And so I become a regular on her show, and I love doing it because I get to speak to a lot of different issues, and I do a lot of youth activism. So I'm very into how young people are being indoctrinated today, rather than just being loved and parented and being taught how to love others, you know? So, I mean, that's what I'm doing today. My background in Hollywood really began on VH1, and I very quickly kind of, you know, started working for all the networks. I did a morning show with Terry Bradshaw on Fox for a season. I, you know, have been under contract at Paramount and at Sony. I hosted a show with three other wacky chicks, Kimora Lee Simmons, Jules Asner, and Lynn Coplitz, a comedian. And we did a show called Life and Style for Sony that aired in syndication for a long time. I used to sit in with Regis when Kathy Lee left the show. Kathy's now a very good friend of mine. So it's kind of funny how life goes. We moved to the same place and have become better friends here than we ever were really in the industry. And yeah, and I left VH1 to go under contract with NBC, where I was given a show called Later that was originally created for Bob Costas and then Greg Kinnear. And it was sort of languishing with a bunch of guest hosts and really didn't have an identity. And I came along and I brought myself to it. That gave it an identity. We started hitting 10 ratings and the network rebranded the show as Later with Cynthia Garrett. And so I did that from 99 to 2001 and I loved it. And I learned a lot about myself as a performer, you know, on that show and as an interviewer and a talent.
That's awesome, Cynthia. No, thank you. Thank you so much. You answered about maybe two or three other questions in the fold as well. I love it. I wouldn't mind dialing the clock back a little bit there. I'd love to know, what was it that exactly made you want to pursue the entertainment industry?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I always wanted to work on television, to, you know, make movies, to be a part of entertainment. I recognized its glamour. I recognized its importance. I recognized how powerful it is, that media, and that media can change the world, that you can speak to people all over the world, that you can touch emotion in people. And so it was just something that as a young person, I just was really drawn to. I also think it had a fair amount to do with a need in myself for validation. I think a lot of performers talk about, you know, the sort of exterior of why you get attracted to the business of show. I honestly really feel that the deeper part of the conversation is really and truly, why do you need millions of people around the globe or around your country to validate your existence? And that is really, I think, you know, at the end of it, it's a lot of that.
So that's funny. The reason I was kind of chuckling as you were saying that, Cynthia, is I have a friend who you may actually know, J. Randy Tarabarelli. He was Michael Jackson's official biographer, and he's written a whole bunch of books that have become miniseries and et cetera, et cetera. Knew everybody, was friends with Diana Ross. And I asked him about the celebrity mindset, psychology. He said that the one common factor of every celebrity he's ever known, from Tom Cruise to Michael Jackson to you name it, is that they all have a need to be liked, which is stronger in them than it might be in someone else, that this overwhelming need to be liked.
I agree with you. I agree with you. There's some brokenness, I think, that's there. And, you know, sometimes people say, you know, oh, the most talented people are crazy. They're a little bit quirky. They're a little bit this. I'm like, yeah, it's called brokenness. I mean, psychologically. And it does produce some incredible expression, you know, and art. And it's because usually I believe that, you know, entertainment gives you the platform and the sort of medium to explore yourself and your pains and your feelings, your joys. It really kind of clues you into yourself. And so that's why, you know, look, I mean, I started as an actor, and that is really and truly, you know, I mentor specifically two young women that I sort of manage and mentor. Both of them are like daughters to me. One is 23. The other one is 27. They're brilliant. One is studying in London right now. The other one is studying in Los Angeles. And I mean, they're both so brilliant. But they also, I've explained to them about, look, let's really look at the psychology of it. You know, one of you's got daddy. No, both of them have daddy issues. You know, fathers who weren't completely present. And I often have said to them, if you approach your art, you know, as a very deep psychological study of yourself in all these characters, you'll be so much better than other people. Because if you can just be real about what this really is, sure, and why you're really doing it, I think you can fearlessly go about this craft. And I do think the best actors, and Denzel Washington told me this, you know, the best actors are just fearless. They're courageous.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. No, extraordinary. Thank you, Cynthia. So on to the late night talk show. I'm really interested. What was it that made you want to host a late night talk show as opposed to, say, a daytime time slot? Was there anything that fed into that decision?
Yeah. When I was a little girl, I was obsessed with Johnny Carson and the Tonight Show. And I studied him. I thought he was a brilliant talent. Here was this man who was so present in his interviews, and he drew out things from people, but he had this very nuanced way of kind of blowing under people's wings. There was something about that that I really admired. And then as I got a little bit older, I loved the way Barbara Walters could draw people out of themselves, the way she could get them to that place where they would become vulnerable on camera and cry. And so in studying the two of them, I really wanted to be able to be someone who could sit down in a conversation and make a person so comfortable that they would open up about the things nearest and dearest and deepest, you know, in their lives. But I realized something that was different about Johnny and about Barbara. As the generations changed, I realized that people become the most comfortable with you if you're comfortable enough to share openly about your own Michigas, you know, your own stuff, your own pains, your own joys, your own fears. And that's where, you know, the fearless part of it came in. I felt like, you know, the most courageous thing that I could do is share the ways in which I've been hurt, you know, or I've been disappointed. And in so doing, I would hopefully make other people feel like, wow, I'm sitting in this conversation with a total stranger, but she's not afraid to show me her heart, you know, and her soul. And so I'm going to open up a little bit also. And I found that to be something that worked really well for me. And I walked into William Morris, to a man named Mark Itkin's office. From the very beginning of my career, I cold called him a tape at William Morris, because he was the pioneer and the champion and the legend who was bringing us alternative television. And I read an article about him one day as one of the players in Hollywood. And it was the way that I read about him and the way that he thought about talent and about alternative programming that made me say, he'll get me. There's something about him that will get me. So I cold called him this tape at William Morris. And, you know, the crazy part of the story is 2 weeks later, I got a call, you know, and an assistant who said, may I speak to Cynthia Garrett? Yes, this is me. Hi, I'm so-and-so from Mark Itkin's office at William Morris, at the William Morris Agency. They weren't yet William Morris Endeavor. Do you have a moment for a call? And, you know, I was on the other end of the phone, you know, like, oh my God, I can't believe this. I can't believe this. Hey, oh my God. And I got on the phone, and we spoke, And he said, I've shown your tape that you cold called to me. And it was a tape of a sample late night talk show that I put together. And I convinced Dennis Rodman to let me interview him. Oh. I convinced Nicole Eggert, who was an actress on Baywatch at the time, to let me interview her. And Little Richard, who was alive and he used to go to my church. And I asked him if he would let me interview him. And I put them all together and I did my version of a late night Johnny Carson talk show. And he asked me, why did you do that format? And I said, it's because I love that format. I love Carson. And I said, but I wanted my interviews to feel more like Barbara Walters interviews. That's why they're longer. And he said, I've shown your tape to a few people. And he said, there's something about you that I rarely see. You are completely transparent and engaging on screen. I'd like for you to come in so that we can meet. And I want to talk about representing you. And I literally went in and I met with him, a guy named John Feriter, who's no longer with us, and Adam Scher, who went on to launch Ryan Seacrest and run Ryan's production company and Kardashians. And Adam is now the head of ITV North America, still a longtime friend of mine. But they signed me. They signed me in the room. And within about 45 days, I was working on camera at VH1 in New York.
Wow, that is awesome. That's a great story, Cynthia.
Yeah.
In your time as a host, was there one particular interview that stood out for you more than others?
Oh, gosh. You know, no, because there were more seasons that's like, you know, I'm probably doing my best work today, which is interesting. And I spend more of my time talking to real people today. And when I hosted talk shows back then, I think what William Morris recognized was that there was something that happened with me and real people, you know, and it was the same thing that happened with celebrities. But the fact that I would actually enjoy talking to real people, you know, was something they really enjoyed on camera. So I say all that to say this, because I am getting to your question. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to isolate a real, you know, sort of a celebrity who is my favorite, because the moments were all so different. When I was a young girl and just starting on VH1, you know, I got to interview Mick Jagger and I got to interview Keith Richards. And I interviewed everyone, you know, Johnny Depp and Bette Midler. And so those were super cool. You know, the music interviews were really cool because I was young and this is like the music I grew up loving and listening to. And even if it was music that was before my time, it was like, who didn't love the Rolling Stones, you know? And my brother is a musician, you know, named Lenny Kravitz. And so, you know, it was cool to be able to say to him, I just got to interview Mick Jagger and I just got to see, you know, Stevie Wonder soundcheck, and George Michael walked out with Aretha Franklin on the stage and like they all just riffed together. And those were the moments that early VH1, you know, used to provide in abundance, and early MTV. And so I loved all of that. But, you know, when I always loved interviewing Denzel. Why? Because Denzel hates interviews. He's a guy that contracts per movie to do only what's necessary and that's it. But he always gave me a little bit extra because he said to me, you know, even though we're friends, this has nothing to do with the fact that we're friends. It's that you're so no BS. He goes, you never ask the stupid question. I watch a lot of other people on camera, hosts on red carpets or hosts in interviews, and they do ask a lot of stupid questions. And I try to put myself in the other person's shoes and never ask, you know, wow, you're nominated for an Oscar. How do you feel? And it's like, okay, you bubblehead. How do you think they feel? Like, engage your brain and try to figure out how to take. Yes, you want to get the how they feel. But you want to get something more that everyone else isn't getting. So how do you take that and make it actually deeper and different? And so I don't know. I guess for people that I was able to do that for, they appreciated it. And Denzel was one of those people, you know. Jimmy Gandolfini before he died. James Gandolfini, because I used to host a show called The Buzz for HBO. And James would only talk to me. Gandolfini was another person who hated interviews. He really didn't like doing interviews. But I'd always get him. They'd always say, okay, you got Jimmy on the carpet, you know, and those were quick and they were easy, but I just really respect those performers who don't really enjoy doing interviews, who carved out that time for me. That those are my favorites, because it's like earning someone's friendship, you know, or their trust. You know, it means that much more. And I like people who don't let me in super easy, you know, because it really means that when they do, they're really real. They're really there.
Right. No, I understand that. And with Denzel Washington, it's interesting. I'm myself aware that he is adverse to giving interviews, say. But when I've seen him give an interview, he's wonderful, and wonderful in a way where he, in my opinion, shows his authenticity, because he'll give very deep answers to the most banal, ridiculous questions. And what I was going to say to you is, I would imagine the reason that the two of you worked so well together was because you both had that degree of authenticity and appreciate it in others. Would you say that's a fair statement?
I would say that's a very fair statement. You know, Josh, it's also a statement that applies to Lenny. You know, I watched Lenny be interviewed in a number of different mediums, and I always tell him, I'm still the favorite interview you've ever done. And it's true, because he's like, girl, nobody knows me like you. You know, he very easily retreats behind the sunglasses and the clothes and is the rock star.
Right.
And the reality is that the Lenny Kravitz that I know, that I've been seriously close to since we were 14 years old and became family in a crazy way. Like, he's a beautiful, thoughtful, funny, you know, kind individual who asks very deep questions and has a very deep faith. And nobody ever gets to that with him. Mm-hmm. It's very, very shallow and surface. You know, it's funny. A guy just wrote a book about him, and, you know, that just came out. And I was kind of like, yeah, well, I can't wait to read the book to see how much of it I actually know I could do better. Because I love him also. And I think when you love a person and you truly appreciate the talent and the skill set of different individuals, it does make you that much better as an interviewer. And whenever I'm going to sit down with somebody, I have to really love them in a way. I have to respect their journey and what they're going through. And honestly, that's a big part of why I do the programming I do now, is because I just can't sit down with a celebrity and fake liking them. I have to really respect them, who they are as a person, what they do, because if I think too much, you know, my mom always says to me, oh, you're going to be cursed your whole life because you chose a career in which you think too much. And the second I have thought you through and you're in front of me on camera, and it's like, I don't care that you've won an Oscar. I think you're a shallow individual who doesn't think about life any deeper than this moment that we're in on this red carpet. And then I'm out.
Yeah.
No, just not interested.
Well, I know Jay Leno actually said something very similar on Rogan. He said that after a while, I just don't care. You've won an Oscar. I just don't care. So he got burnt out on it.
Yeah, it's hard to fake. And it's hard to fake it.
Well, because I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there. A discerning audience will pick up on the fakeness. They just will, and they will hate it. One of, you know, not going to ask you to give any thoughts on Jimmy Fallon, but isn't that what the big knock against Fallon is, that he fake laughs? People pick up on it. Right?
Yeah, they do. Oh, they do. You know, Jerry Lewis told me something before he died. Jerry was one of my mentors. I used to co-host the telethon with him because I had a cousin who had muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point in my career, I was on VH1. And I was interviewing all these rock stars, but I said to the head of the network, I was like, look, I'd really love to do something that moves my soul. So like, you know, whether it's programming or something, charity, I don't know, but we need to do something that's like a give back. And like literally a month later, Jerry Lewis called and said, I like this girl. You know, she seems like she actually is really authentic. I want to meet her. That was it. And they said to me, would you go meet Jerry Lewis? I got on a plane in New York. I flew to LA. It was 3 days before the Jerry Lewis, the 24-hour telethon, right? I meet with Jerry. We're having a conversation. And I said, did you know that I have a cousin who died of muscular dystrophy and your organization was really involved in like my family's life? And he was like, are you kidding me? And I said, no, I'm not. And he goes, hold on a second. Now I'm in a room with him and five men and like all old school Hollywood guys, right? And they start playing these appeals of these kids with muscular dystrophy. And I mean, I'm wrecked. I'm in tears. And Jerry looked at me and he goes, are you busy this weekend? And I said, well, no, I was going to do whatever. And he goes, can you cancel your plans? And I said, sure, why? And he goes, I want you live with me on the telethon. And I was like, with you and Ed McMahon and Larry King? Like, what? And that started, I think, a 10-year relationship doing the program with him. And we were friends until the day he died. I'm still friends with his little daughter, Danny, who kind of grew up on that stage with my son. And he was a great mentor to me. And he used to always say, that little box called television looks right into your soul. And when you're faking it, people know. Because performers might live in a certain bubble, but the real world lives in the real world. So make sure you stay connected to the real world. And that was the advice I always got from guys like him, Ed McMahon. Dick Clark used to tell me the same thing. Like, if you're faking it, you should quit.
Right. Extraordinary. I love it. I'd like to maybe address any production students that might be listening to us. Right. Let's see. I'll put it this way. So these days, obviously, it's a new medium with, you know, podcasts like this one and YouTube and so forth. Would you say it would take a huge production crew and lighting and cameras to create successful shows? Or would you say like cell phone videos posted to YouTube would be just as effective?
Okay, let me turn that back around and ask you a question, because I have a very definitive answer to that one from every old school legend that mentored me, that's been a part of my life, and from my own experiences. A pretty girl does not need a lot of makeup. If the substance and the beauty is there, it's there.
It will shine through.
Yeah, the lights, the cameras. No, it does not take any of that to be a great success. I think more today than ever, your generation of young people, and I'm assuming you're probably young, like in your 30s or something. Mm-hmm. Well, your generation has, I love it. Like, you guys are way more authentic. You're into the indie film and the indie production, and the world has changed to where we're walking around with this thing called an iPhone, and we can make a feature length film. And it doesn't matter to success as much as it used to, I think, in my generation and before, that the lights are perfect, the makeup's perfect, the hair is perfect. It doesn't even matter to me. I don't care if my lighting is perfect or my makeup is perfect. I've never been that girl. I'm more interested in, is somebody watching me going, I can't take my eyes off of her and what she's saying and how she's saying it. Or I want to hear him. I want to hear his opinions. I want to know what they're talking about. Like, to me, that's really what people are vibing to today. It's authenticity.
Sure. You know, that makes sense to me. You know, this might be sort of the same question rephrased. If you already answered it, just tell me, Cynthia, and I'll be happy to move on. But, you know, we have people like Conan O'Brien, one of my personal favorites, finding success in podcasting and having the freedom of the long form conversation, right? He's able to ask more in-depth questions and really dig into discussions, which I notice is becoming popular, to put it mildly. And I'm curious if you've thought about how that might change the television medium, what effect that might have.
Well, I think the television medium has already been affected, at least traditional network television, because, like, I don't really watch network TV. I go to Amazon Prime or Netflix and I binge watch what I want to binge watch. I go to Apple, you know, I go to HBO. I think cable, you know, and pay TV anyway, subscription television kind of started impacting kind of the whole TV, traditional TV anyway. But podcasting is really, that's a really a great question that you ask, because I think that people listen more on the go than watch. And that's really, and I would have never thought that was true, because I like to watch people while I listen. But even my Girl Club series, they're more successful in terms of numbers on podcasts than they are live streaming. And you can live stream through my Cynthia Garrett Ministries YouTube channel and actually, like, ask questions and interact, and we'll shout you out and talk about you, like, while it's happening in real time. But it's really interesting. But the podcast numbers, people really love to watch on podcasts. And so I think you do both, but you understand the power of the on the go. I can listen in my car, you know. It's funny, I do a lot of ministry and itinerant teaching, and podcasts and listening to a sermon on tape have been huge for decades. So it doesn't really surprise me, because I think about how many times I would really just like, okay, I can't make a church on Sunday, but I can listen on, I'll buy the tape and I'll listen to the tape, you know, right. Or now it's, I'll just listen to the podcast. It's kind of interesting.
No, it's extremely interesting. And even tacking on to that, I mean, if you had told me 10 years ago that people will willingly listen to a 5 hour long podcast, I would have thought you were nuts. I mean, even an hour and a half seems like a lot, but I mean, you know, every big podcast, well, we'll just stick with Rogan, for instance. I mean, it's not uncommon for him to have someone on for 4 hours, you know?
I know. Is that crazy? That I'd love to do his show. I think he's fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. I like him a lot.
I've been watching a lot of the guys that have gotten big in these mediums lately, like Joe Rogan or Andrew Tate. I did not know who Andrew Tate was until 2 nights ago when I was watching Kanye on Pierce, you know, mm-hmm. I was catching it. Right,
I saw
after
that too.
The fact. Yeah, right. And then it sort of, you know, because you're watching YouTube, so it kind of just goes into the next one. And so I sort of dozed off and I woke up and this guy is on and I'm like, who's this guy and why is he on Pierce Morgan? And so I just sat and listened and I was like, I had no idea this guy was this big, you know, like, oh, who is he? You know, who knew? And it is really interesting because, like, when did you ever just stumble onto stuff like that? Now I feel like I stumble onto podcasts. I stumble onto things on YouTube that'll lead me somewhere else. It's very interesting what's happened, you know, to the things that entertain us. And it's long form interview. I agree. It's like what I always love. I mean, maybe I was ahead of my time, but I used to always say, okay, well, I want to sit down and talk for a couple hours. And people would look at me like I was nuts. Now you can, you know, you can do that on podcast or not. I need a radio show, I guess.
So I would imagine there's some pretty stark differences between working at a network and then, of course, working independently. I was wondering if you could maybe run through any differences, what you like or dislike between the two.
Yeah, money.
We're both capitalists here, right?
Yeah, right. Yes, I love capitalism. Never let it be said that I am part of the African Americans who dislike capitalism. That is the biggest lie sold to us in the presidential wars last time. Black people love capitalism. We all love capitalism. People want to come to America because of capitalism, because you have an opportunity to start with nothing and become something huge.
Yep.
That's not a bad thing. That's a beautiful, like, dream, right? No, I'm telling you, that's really it. Doing it independently means you're funding more, you're self-funding maybe, you're raising money, you're finding allies in a whole different way. When you're on network, it's a beautiful thing to be able to do what you do and have the instruments there to make the song. You know, it's like you don't have to worry about the cameras and the lighting and the, you know, and all of that because it is there. Whether it's important or not doesn't matter. It's an added thing that's there. And that's great. Maybe you're getting paid to do what you do. And it feels really good to earn, you know, for the fruits of your labor. Like, I love this form of an interview that you're doing. Like,
thank you.
You know, why doesn't a network pay for it? Like, I don't know. Yeah, I love everything about, you know, doing something that is in, you know, more of a network, kind of a bigger budget thing. It's all great. But what's not great is when that particular medium or a medium becomes so big that it then starts trying to make everyone happy. So it starts censoring you and pushing you into a certain narrative that it wants to sell. And I'm not the girl that's going to be pushed into anybody's narrative. Not at this time, not at this point in my life. I don't care that much, you know?
Right. I understand that. The irony is if when something tries to be all things and everything to all people, ironically, you alienate everybody. Because again, we go back to the lack of authenticity, don't we?
Totally. Totally. You know. Totally. Certain kinds of people exist for certain kinds of people. And that's okay. As long as I can have my female perspective or my, you know, mixed race perspective, what do I care? It makes the world go round. We will never all be the same. And we will never all exist in a world in which no one says anything that hurts someone else's feelings. That is such crap. I can't stand it. Everybody doesn't get a trophy. They don't. That's it. Competition is not about everyone winning.
Yep.
It ain't. you know, and I was raised by parents who taught me that, like, you get in and scrap for yours. It's okay.
So was I. I'd love to just get an inside opinion. So I mentioned, you know, Conan O'Brien earlier. You must have some thoughts on the late night war between him and Leno. I'd love to know what your thoughts were on that and just kind of maybe how you come out on it.
Well, I used to come on after Leno and Conan when I had my show. So I've been on Conan's show. I'm a Conan O'Brien fan also. I thought he was just brilliant and quirky and funny.
Absolutely.
And honestly, I think he got screwed over. I think he got big time screwed over by the network. And I think it was pretty selfish of Dave, actually, because I just care about other people. And if I was in Dave's position, I'd have taken my hundreds of millions of dollars and said, you know what? I know I want to come back because my ego can't get enough of this stroke, but I'm going to screw this other guy over. And it's not so cool. So maybe I'll just take my private plane and I'll just go play on an island and, you know, and just stick to the decision I made. And if I want to do something else, I can create something else or do something else with them. But I don't know how much of a part he was with that. I just have to believe that these were two big, important guys to NBC. And I was at NBC. And I know the kowtowing that, you know, went on, obviously, toward the Tonight Show.
It's
the big franchise player. But I think Conan got really jerked around in all of that.
Yeah.
And it's too bad.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, Conan O'Brien, I think probably my dream celebrity interview would be him and I guess Edward Norton. But
oh, I love Ed. Oh, I love Ed. I screen tested with him for a film once. He requested me, actually.
And really?
Yeah. What? He was a fan of mine on VH1. Who knew? And and I got a call from my agents one day and they said, Ed Norton wants to test with you for this film called Keeping the Faith.
Oh, yes.
Jenna Elfman ended up getting the role. But
Wow.
But I mean, I thought, how super cool of him that he was willing to open it up to me, go against type maybe that they had for the role. And just great. What a uber cool, real, down to earth, super freaking talented guy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's extremely interesting. Yeah, and this will show you what a nerd I am. So for our listeners, Keeping the Faith, great movie, underrated, directed by the great Milos Forman. And it's Edward Norton and Ben Stiller. So just to impress you with my movie nerdiness.
I love that. You just knew that right away. I love movie nerdiness. I'm kind of movie nerdy myself, Josh. I mean, I'm really a child of the two. Like, I don't apologize. Some people are, I don't watch TV or movies. I read books. I'm like, God, you don't know what you're missing. Like, I love television and movies. I like to dissect scripts and I love the cinematography and I love great acting. And I just appreciate the whole thing of the enchilada. Like, it's good.
Absolutely. No, I love it. I love it. Actually, Keeping the Faith is actually a wonderful little segue to my next question. So,
yeah.
You know, you've talked about your, let's call them perhaps tribulations that renewed your faith in God. Do you feel comfortable maybe discussing that a little?
Sure. Of course. I was, Josh, as a young girl, I was sexually abused by a relative in my home. And I didn't know until years later that it happened also to my only little sister. Mm. And it was really kind of carrying the pain and the shame of that into my early 20s, that I realized, like, I was beginning to unravel from the inside out. You know, I was a super high achiever in school, but I became the textbook survivor of childhood sexual abuse, meaning I was an overachiever. I was the straight A student. I was, you know, very goal oriented and success oriented, but kind of looking for love in all the wrong places. And at a certain point in my life, you know, through my first book is all about this. It's called Prodigal Daughter, A Journey Home to My Identity. And you can pick it up on Amazon. And if you really want to read the whole story, it is pretty crazy. The details are pretty insane. I ran off as a very young girl in the midst of all of this searching and this pain, trying to deal with how do I tell someone that I was sexually molested for, you know, repeatedly over the course of a couple of years as a young girl. And it's jacking me up inside. and it's affecting how I see relationships with guys. And in the middle of all of that, I ran off overseas and got married to someone who seemed like he was great, but he turned out to be a really bad, bad guy. And I ended up getting arrested with him on our honeymoon because I discovered he was up to no good trafficking drugs internationally from Paris into Italy. I got arrested with him in Italy, ended up in a prison cell in Italy, where I went on to become the star witness in a 2-year trial against this man that I married, who it turned out had a completely assumed identity. Like, it's the craziest flipping story. I mean, I literally remember being over there in prison, and who was it? Some actress. Which actress was it? Elfrey Woodard. One of her representatives basically reached out to me through someone else to ask if she could buy the rights to my story. And I was like, you know what? Could you shut your head in a refrigerator right now? Because, like, this isn't a movie. This is my very real life. And anyway, I was there a couple of years really testifying and going through trial after trial. And it's a long, you know, honestly, it's a great book. I buy the book. But to make a long story short, I found my faith in that experience in a prison cell in Italy. And I found it all alone. And I came to understand what the phrase born again means, because I really felt like I was being rebirthed. You know, I was born again to something new and wonderful. And it gave me a higher purpose, and it gave me an understanding of myself. And through the years, as my faith has grown and morphed and evolved and changed, it continues to give me the anchor that I hold on to in every storm, every physical storm, mental storm, emotional storm, every life challenge. It's like the only thing that I really know is real for me.
Your North Star.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And it makes me able to forgive even my relative who abused me. It's given me the ability to forgive, because I believe that Jesus Christ died to forgive me of my sins. And so who am I to not forgive others? Now, it doesn't mean that it's a Disney movie and we're going to reengage and I'm going to let him babysit my children. No, God gives us wisdom. You know, I call that my Old Testament God gives me wisdom. He doesn't say, you know, here's your savior, be stupid, and we love everybody to the detriment of ourselves. That's not godly wisdom. No. But because of my faith, my godly wisdom tells me if I embrace Jesus, I also have to embrace forgiveness. And so I try not to live my life with unforgiveness shackled to my feet. I try to cut it off, let it go, give it to God, and keep it moving. And it's about my freedom, you know, because I'm free when I live my life that way. I'm not free when I live my life holding on to unforgiveness.
Right. Do you know what Mark Twain said about forgiveness?
No, tell me.
Forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the hill that has crushed it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. I wish I thought of it.
Yeah, but you're deep enough to have gone to Mark Twain. So I applaud you.
Again, we're back in that nerdiness.
I love it.
What's next for you, Cynthia?
Ah, that's a good question, Josh. And honestly, I don't know that I know per se. I know that I will every Monday do my live stream of Girl Club, you know, 9 a.m. on the West Coast, 12 noon on the East Coast, and 11 p.m. in Central Standard Time, because I know that people get impacted by it, and I get letters and emails from women and men saying, oh my gosh, you know, this is helping me to confront this issue, or it's helping me to overcome that issue. And so that's beautiful for me. And I know that I find great strength and encouragement and breakthrough every Monday when I'm doing it. So I know I'll continue to do that. I will continue to be prayerful that that grows, you know, and that more people are able to see it. But what's next for me? I don't know. You know, I sometimes think about politics because I care so deeply about the state of affairs of our nation. I just think we're just messed up by a bunch of fake, phony people who don't care to really touch other people's pain, poverty, or position in life. They really don't. They just speak platitudes and make promises. And I don't know. I'm kind of ready for someone who says, I don't really know how to do this, but I know that I care And I know I can do a better job than everyone else at picking good people and putting good people around me, because this country is about we the people. It's not about us here at the top who will have a political platform. So I hate what I see. And so I do think a lot about politics. I haven't ruled that out of my life or my future.
Yeah. You know. There's a whole other podcast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful. Most important question, Cynthia Garrett, how can people find out about you?
Well, cynthiagarrett.org. So Cynthia, C-Y-N-T-H-I-A, Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T.org. And you can find everything about the different series that I host and the different things that I do and that are important to me and ways in which you can help others.
Excellent. Cynthia, this was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. I enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, Josh, I thank you for, I'm like, why does he want to interview me? But thank you. You know, thanks for caring about my story and thanks for what you do and just caring about stories and bringing them to all of us and, you know, keep doing what you're doing. You're really just, you're great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. No, likewise. I guess I will let you go then. I hope you have a great rest of the day, Cynthia.
Thanks, Josh. You too. Bye-bye to all your listeners.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.